SDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. U.S. companies that rely on imports are still trying to figure out a way forward under President Trump's expansive tariff regime. We hear from a business owner on the front lines.
In my opinion, these tariffs, all it does is stymie innovation. Nobody's going to want to make products.
Also, a new museum in Chicago takes a look at the history of public housing in the United States. A look at the college women's basketball championship later today in Tampa. And Stranger Things star Finn Wolfhard makes his directing debut with the horror comedy Hell of a Summer. It's Sunday, April 6th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The organizers of the hands-off protests say they'll be holding more events in the coming weeks. Hundreds of rallies were held across the country yesterday to protest President Trump. From member station KQED, Billy Cruz covered the gathering in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Thousands of protesters in downtown Oakland carried signs supporting various government programs. The programs differ, but what brings everyone together is their message to President Trump and advisor Elon Musk to keep their hands off. Katie Romer is a registered nurse in Oakland.
Hands off of all of it. Hands off of our Medicaid, hands off of our VA nurses, hands off of our union rights. The reason we have these services is because people of our country have decided that that is something that's important, that we take care of one another. And as nurses, we want to support that.
Other attendees said they were worried about threats to education, climate initiatives, social security, and diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI programs. For NPR News, I'm Billy Cruz in Oakland.
The rallies reflect discontent with the Trump administration 11 weeks into his second term. NPR's Mara Liasson reports people are angry.
We've had a lot of actual data from voters. There were two Florida special elections in very red congressional districts this week. The Republican candidates did win, but their margins of victory were cut in half from 2024. So anger is a very, very powerful motivator in politics, and it seems to be working against the president and his party right now.
NPR's Mara Liasson. Lawmakers in Florida are debating a reduction in the state's child labor protections. From member station WFSU, Tristan Wood reports.
Florida's considering allowing 16-year-olds to work more than the current 30-hour-a-week cap and loosening some limits on 14-year-olds if they're in homeschool, virtual education, or already graduated. Nina Mast, a policy analyst at the Washington-based Economic Policy Institute, says the rollbacks nationally are being championed by business industry groups looking to drive down wages that went up in lower-paying industries during the pandemic.
This is really a concerted nationwide effort to essentially create a permanent underclass of disempowered low-wage workers.
Supporters of the bill say it gives minor employment choices to parents and gives teens experiences they need as adults. For NPR News, I'm Tristan Wood in Tallahassee.
Floodwaters continue to rise in parts of the U.S. South and Midwest after days of rain. Officials report at least 16 weather-related deaths over the weekend. The National Weather Service warns roads, bridges, and other critical infrastructure could be at risk. This is NPR News. Ukrainian officials say a Russian missile attack overnight killed at least one person in the capital, Kyiv. At least three others were wounded. The strikes also set off fires and damaged buildings. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the continuing attacks show Russian President Vladimir Putin does not want to end the three-year-old war. Israel has renamed a butterfly species after a young hostage killed in Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
The eastern knapweed fritillary, known in Hebrew as the orange Jerusalem butterfly, has been renamed the orange Ariel butterfly after four-year-old redhead Ariel Bibas. His story is well known in Israel. His family was among the hundreds of people taken hostage in the Hamas-led attack on Israel October 7th, 2023. The father was released from Gaza this year, but the child, his mother, and 9-month-old brother were all killed while being held hostage. Their bodies were released this year. The 4-year-old loved butterflies, his father said in a eulogy. Israel's Hebrew Language Academy said in a letter to the father it hoped the butterfly's new name would be a kind of comfort. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Pope Francis appeared in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican today in his first public appearance since being discharged from the hospital 2 weeks ago. He entered in his wheelchair, waved to the crowd, and spoke briefly. The 88-year-old pontiff had been admitted to the hospital February 14th with a case of bronchitis that developed into pneumonia. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Thousands of federal health agency workers lost their jobs last week. Whole laboratories and divisions were shut down, not just in Washington, D.C., but in West Virginia and Florida and Washington State. It's part of an overhaul of the Department of Health and Human Services under its new secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. NPR Science Desk was working long hours last week talking to workers who lost their jobs and those left behind. Selena Simmons-Duffin covers HHS, Rob Stein covers the National Institutes of Health, and Sydney Lupkin covers the Food and Drug Administration. Welcome.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
Hi.
Selena, let's start with you. How many people lost their jobs across HHS?
Well, what Secretary Kennedy said 2 weeks ago was that 10,000 people would be cut, on top of about 10,000 employees who have already taken early retirement or otherwise left. And just to remind people, HHS is the umbrella health agency. It oversees the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, along with NIH, FDA, Medicare, and more. We don't know exactly how many layoff notices went out, let alone the details of who was cut. HHS did not respond to NPR's request for comment on those numbers. Even managers at HHS don't have that information. In some cases, they've had to email to figure out who was still working on their teams. There have been some crowdsourcing efforts to figure out exactly who is gone and put it into a spreadsheet. One team that I heard was gone at CDC, I asked a source of mine to go and look at their office, and he confirmed it was just empty cubicles. But that just gives you a sense of how people have been piecing together what happened here.
And Sydney, what about FDA?
Yeah, at FDA, we don't know the full picture either, but an official who was laid off and fears retribution for speaking publicly told me more than 800 people were fired from the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. That's the division that's responsible for new drug approvals, as well as monitoring unexpected side effects and making label changes. Many of them were funded by user fees paid by the industry, so not taxpayers. And that division, like a lot of the federal government, already had a hard time attracting and retaining staff because people with that expertise can make a lot more money in the private sector.
And Rob, what about NIH? What was the impact there?
So I'm told about 1,300 employees were laid off at the sprawling NIH campus just outside Washington, D.C. And I'm hearing there's widespread anger, despair, fear, confusion. Most of those who were cut appear to have been involved in administrative jobs, like dozens of people whose job was to communicate with the public, update websites, IT workers, HR people, specialists who handle contracts and grants. Now, these may sound like expendable bureaucratic jobs, but the scientists searching for cures for everything from asthma, allergies, and Alzheimer's to AIDS, cancer, and heart disease literally can't do their jobs without this kind of support. And on top of all that, a slew of top leaders, along with some senior scientists, have been placed on administrative leave.
And now, in addition to the layoffs, HHS has also been ordered to cut spending on outside contracts. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. HHS spokesman Andrew Nixon confirmed in an email to NPR that the department must cut 35% of what it spends on contracts. So the contracts could include things like cleaning services or computer support, but they could also be contracts for specialized equipment for medical research, such as freezer storage for biospecimens, or work with outside laboratories for tests. They often cover functions that are specialized and just not large enough to warrant hiring full-time employees.
At CDC, I'm told they're supposed to find $2.9 billion in contracts to cut. A former official I spoke with who didn't want to be named for fear of retribution says that is a, quote, mission-killing amount. There is no way to skim off fat and get that kind of money, and it'll shut down programs required by Congress. Already, CDC was really hit hard in the firings. Whole branches and divisions were shut down. A division that researched worker safety is 80% gone. The department that worked on violence prevention was slashed. And an FDA lab that monitored food safety in San Francisco was closed down, too. So this is not just consolidating or streamlining that's happening here.
Sydney, you reported last week about the people who handle the Freedom of Information Act request at these agencies. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the layoffs last week included entire teams responsible for fulfilling public requests for government documents. And this was sort of a surprise because even before Kennedy was confirmed, he was saying that he wanted to bring, quote, radical transparency to HHS. So these are the workers who handle requests and provide these records for everyone in the public, not just journalists. And I'm told these firings will mean that people getting these records, it'll just be slower and harder.
But, you know, as an example of all the confusion swirling around all of this, I'm told six employees in the main NIH FOIA office who had been cut have now been asked to return, at least temporarily. But I'm told the NIH will have to offset anyone who does come back with corresponding cuts elsewhere.
And what's the bigger picture here? Are more people who were fired going to be unfired?
It is unclear right now. Health Secretary Kennedy told reporters on Thursday that the department will reinstate as much as 20% of those who were cut. In fact, he said that that was the plan all along and that they knew some mistakes would inevitably be made. He has not yet said who that will be. For instance, he suggested a team on CDC that works on lead poisoning was cut mistakenly, but then the agency said that it wasn't a mistake. Right now, it's just a lot of rumors and a lot of confusion and a lot of worries about what might be coming next.
That was Selena Simmons-Duffin, Rob Stein, and Sydney Lupkin. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll know you'll stay on this, and we'll be listening for your reports.
Thanks for having us.
Sure thing.
You bet.
When President Trump levied tariffs on China during his first term in office, many companies looked for alternative places to make their products. Countries in Southeast Asia were eager for their business and opened their doors. Today, half of all Nike shoes are made in Vietnam. After Trump slapped them with 46% tariffs last week, Vietnam is no longer so appealing. Now, Hanoi and Washington say they are in talks, and the president suggested on social media that tariffs could drop to zero. But it's hard to know what will actually happen. Patrick Sun owns the Alliance Trading Group. They help U.S. companies find manufacturers in Asia to make their products. He's based in Portland, Oregon, but he's currently in Taiwan. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here, Aisha.
Tell me about your company, like how many clients and what do you do for them?
We are a sourcing, product development, and quality control company. We have about 50 customers, predominantly in the United States. They're comprised of mostly small-ish businesses, single entrepreneurs to companies that range to about $20 to $100 million.
You source products from China, Vietnam, Thailand, and Indonesia, among others. And now all of those are subject to these substantial tariffs. Where are you looking in order to get the best deal for your U.S. customers?
The number that stood out was the Philippines. They showed a 17% rate, or I believe now it's 18%, versus the 46 you see in Vietnam, the 34 out of China, the 36 out of Thailand, mid-30s for Indonesia, Myanmar.
And does the Philippines have the necessities that your customers would need to get their products made?
We're going to find out. I'm actually heading to the Philippines on Monday to touch base with some factories there and look and see what their capabilities are. There is predominantly a lot of manufacturing in the Philippines for certain components and certain types of industries, but it's definitely not as robust as you would find in Vietnam or in China.
Are any of your customers thinking, we'll just build a factory or use factories in the U.S. and then we won't have to worry about tariffs?
It's just not that simple. That takes years. It takes dollars. It takes time to implement. In the United States, it's just too expensive. So you could throw 100% tariffs on a product in China. You're still going to get a better deal out of it than making it in the United States. It's still going to be cheaper overall to the final consumer. It's also been decades since there's been robust supply chain in the United States, and it's just not going to be that easy to find someone who wants to make a complex premium product for us.
Do you think that Americans want the jobs that are being done in China and Southeast Asia, like building parts for tripods, making shoes, making bags?
I don't think so. These jobs are minimum wage jobs, slightly above minimum wage jobs in Vietnam, in China, everywhere. Factory jobs, assembling product, working with your hands. If you bring those jobs into the United States, you're probably going to get minimum wage or above minimum wage factory workers. And I just don't really understand why that's what the goal is to bring in jobs that are going to make it hard for the average American to put food on their table.
We don't know how this is going to shake out because President Trump has put tariffs on Canada and Mexico, then pulled back. And last week, Trump, after speaking to his counterpart in Vietnam, said he might drop the tariff rate to zero. But does that solve your problems? Do you then stop looking at other places?
That's the problem with this, which is tariffs can be implemented within a moment's notice by just saying the word, I want 10%, 34%, 50% tariffs on whatever country it is. But the actual effects and the ramifications of it is if we're trying to move manufacturing, it takes years. In my opinion, these tariffs, all it does is stymie innovation. It's going to make people more hesitant to say, hey, I'm going to do the grueling work to start my own business and create my own product because, well, I'm not going to sell as many anymore.
That's Patrick Soon, the founder and CEO of the Alliance Trading Group in Portland, Oregon. We reached him in Taiwan. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Aisha.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The Israeli military is acknowledging that its account of the killing of 15 Palestinian medics in Gaza last month was wrong, that the emergency vehicles were using their lights and sirens when they came under Israeli fire. The U.S. is revoking all visas held by holders of passports from South Sudan. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says that country is taking advantage of the U.S. by not accepting the timely return of its citizens. And in men's college basketball, the University of Houston beat Duke last night. In the other Final Four game, Florida beat Auburn. The NCAA championship game is tomorrow night in San Antonio. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Made in Cookware, Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. In just a few hours, college basketball will crown its 2025 women's champions. Defending champions South Carolina take on 11-time champions Connecticut. And the season finale will feature one of the all-time greats trying to finally get their hands on the top prize. Steve Futterman is covering the contest in Tampa and joins us now. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Aisha.
So let's start with those two teams. They're pretty elite, aren't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, no matter who wins today, and UConn, by the way, is the favorite, some sort of history will be made. As you mentioned, South Carolina is the defending champion, and a Carolina win today would make it not just two straight titles, but three out of the last four, which these days usually earns you the title of a mini dynasty. Only two schools have ever shown this kind of dominance on the women's side, Tennessee in the late 1990s and UConn on several occasions. Now, you mentioned UConn winning 11 times. Well, the 12th title today would make the UConn women the most successful program, women or men, topping the legendary UCLA men's program that over the years has featured great players like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Walton. The UCLA men, like the UConn women, have won 11 titles.
Now, what about the matchup? Isn't the first time these two teams have played this year?
That's right. And they played in February. It was no contest. UConn simply destroyed South Carolina 87-58, a 29-point win. The game was played at South Carolina, and it ended Carolina's 71-game, four-year home winning streak. Now, yesterday, as the players, as they traditionally do the day before the game, met with reporters, that game was brought up. One of Carolina's top players, Tahina Pau-Pau, said she issued a mea culpa to her teammates after that loss.
I knew I could have done better for my team, and I just felt like I let them down, and I knew I had to tell them that because I wanted to take accountability for that and knowing that I didn't perform my best.
And she's been playing great since then. On Friday night, Aisha, in the semifinal game against Texas, Pau-Pau was the Carolina's leading scorer with 14 points.
There's little doubt, though, who's the biggest name in this year's Women's Final Four. It's UConn's Paige Beckers. She's had a legendary tour, but she's never been a part of a championship team.
That's right. And let's make clear, win or lose today, Paige Beckers has had one of the greatest careers ever in women's college basketball. In her freshman year, when she was only 19, she was named Player of the Year. She's overcome an ACL tear, missing an entire season. You ask pretty much anyone who's played with her or against her, they talk about her remarkable basketball IQ. Listen to her coach, Gina Auriemma.
I trust Paige to do the right thing ever since her freshman year. She just is the most incredibly positive human being I've ever been around.
Now, Beckers has come close to winning a championship three times. She's been in the Final Four, like today. And once in 2022, she was in the title game against, guess who? South Carolina. Yesterday, she talked about what today is likely going to be like.
I'm probably going to be sad regardless of the outcome, just knowing that my college career is over. And this is my last time wearing the UConn uniform, so just enjoying that, embracing it, making sure I have nothing left to give after that game.
And the tip-off for today's championship game is 3 p.m. Eastern time.
That's Steve Futterman in Tampa. Steve, thank you so much.
Great to be with you, Aisha.
One of America's first examples of public housing are the Jane Addams Homes in Chicago, built in 1938 and named for the trailblazing reformer. Fast forward to now, and there are some 1 million public housing units in the U.S., and the Addams Homes are getting a second act as a museum dedicated to telling the story of public housing. From Chicago, Allison Cuddy reports.
Public housing has taken many forms, from high-rises to single-family homes. The National Public Housing Museum is housed in a three-story red brick building in the heart of Chicago's historic Little Italy neighborhood. Inside and out, everything looks brand new. The curvy Art Deco metal balconies are freshly painted. Large multi-paned windows flood the interior with light. There are exhibitions, a recording studio, art installations, even a small room where visitors can spin records made by people who lived in public housing. On the second floor, Executive Director Lisa Yen Lee leads a group through a trio of apartments furnished in historic period detail from the 1930s to the 1970s.
Feel free to take a seat.
Nobody wants to sit on the furniture. You can totally sit on the furniture.
I'll sit on the furniture.
Sit on the furniture.
In the small living room, a green striped couch sits next to an end table covered with framed family photos and a page from a war ration book. The kitchen floor has checkerboard linoleum. These details, plus oral histories, evoke the presence of the real people who lived here across the decades, like a Jewish family, one of the earliest residents.
So this was Inez Turvitz. She was such a lovely character.
From a vintage cathedral-style radio, the recorded voice of Inez's niece, Tina Turovitz Birnbaum, recalls her family's story.
My Bubby Molly and Zadie settled on the south side of Chicago, but when the Great Depression hit, they, like many other people, needed an affordable place to live, and they heard about the Jane Addams Homes.
In the 1930s, public housing held promise for many. Returning veterans, immigrants, and others found community there. Many still do. In the History Lessons exhibition, Education Ambassador Gentry Quinones points to objects donated by former and current public housing residents, including Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who lived in public housing as a child.
She told her story of living in the projects in New York City, and she was gracious enough to share some pictures with us.
By the 1960s and 70s, public housing came to be seen in a negative light, as places where poverty, crime, and segregation were concentrated and persisted. Disinvestment left the buildings in disrepair. Lee says the museum wants to change the narrative about public housing then and now, without exploiting images or stories of suffering, which she calls poverty porn.
How do you tell traumatic stories so that you don't re-traumatize people? How do you tell these tragic stories so that people listen with empathy?
For Lee and her staff, the answer is simple. Start with the experiences of residents. Their stories are woven throughout the museum, including their role in its origins. In the late 90s, as Chicago began to tear down its public housing, demolishing around 25,000 units, some public housing residents waged a long and hard-won fight to save this building, hoping it could be a place to tell their story. It took decades before their idea for a museum was approved. Abandoned since 2002, a lot of work was required to bring this building back to life. Francine Washington is on the board of the museum. She says the museum does reflect her experiences as a public housing resident. She hopes it challenges stereotypes.
I love this place. This is a place called home. People get to see our plight, to see that we have the same blood type, they want the same thing in our life that they want.
The need for affordable housing remains. The waiting list for public housing in Chicago is over 100,000 people. It can take years or even decades to get in. The museum wants to intervene in that reality. It offers paid workforce development programs for public housing residents. Some may even live there in one of 15 mixed-income housing units in a wing of the building separate from the museum. Lee says all of it is critical to the museum's mission to advocate for housing as a human right.
We believe that in order to preserve history, you have to make it relevant to the most critical social justice issues of today, and that there is no way that we can actually address any of the social issues that we want to unless we go back in time and ask what have we not yet learned from history.
That's a question that Lee and others hope the National Public Housing Museum will help people answer. For NPR News, I'm Allison Cuddy in Chicago.
Over the 2 years of Sudan's civil war, NPR has been in touch with Dua Tarek. She's part of a vast network of volunteers called the Emergency Response Rooms, nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize last year for their life-saving work. Like many others, she never left Khartoum, where the fighting between former allies started and which was occupied by the paramilitary group at war with the Sudanese army. Now the army has retaken the city, and NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu caught back up with Tariq.
This was Dua Tariq's life in the initial weeks of the war. In the day, she sheltered at home from airstrikes and artillery guns. But when fighting subsided at night, she and a group of activists went out into the streets. They'd sing hopeful songs to other residents trapped inside from the fighting exploding across Khartoum.
Oh, revolutionary, continue chanting. Tell the people of the neighborhood, I'm coming as long as I'm alive. You're safe, don't be scared.
But then it got too dangerous, and the song stopped.
Actually, my neighborhood also is getting attacked and bombed. Three people were killed within the past 40 minutes in my neighborhood. It's very scary.
Throughout the war, she sent voice notes to NPR from her home, where she was sheltering with her family, including her newborn son. Fighting broke out between the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group and their former ally, the Sudanese army, nearly 2 years ago. Both sides had launched a coup in 2021 against the first civilian-led government in decades, but then they went to war with each other for control of the country.
The bullets are so loud and the fear on the children's eyes is so, just so frustrating, because all we can do is to support and provide hugs, but also us, we need to be hugged. But right now, most of the people I know have left Khartoum seeking shelter and safety. Most of the people I know here are planning to leave the city.
The RSF took over Khartoum and carried out unprecedented atrocities, looting the city of virtually everything valuable and carrying out mass killings, sexual violence, and torture.
It's shocking, it's traumatizing, it's life-changing, it's a completely tough experience.
But the turning point came last month. The Sudanese army recaptured the capital for the first time after gradually advancing across the Khartoum state region. As soldiers celebrated, groups of civilians who'd endured the worst gradually poured out into eerie streets. And civilians like Dua Tariq left their homes without fear for the first time.
I went to the main road and celebrated with the people.
Much of Khartoum is unrecognizable, swathes of it torched, destroyed and looted. But the recapture by the army has given many residents like Tariq a new sense of freedom.
I did simple things, but it felt so important and felt so different. It felt so fun, actually. I had fun.
And the chance to do ordinary things she missed.
I rode a bicycle and I went grocery shopping without hiding the money in my chest. I was laughing in the streets. I played music before I was hiding my speakers.
The war is still being fought across Sudan and the toll has been immense. Up to 150,000 people have been killed and more than 15 million people have been displaced. Hundreds of thousands are suffering famine, and a genocide in the western region of Darfur has been committed by the RSF and allied Arab militias against African ethnic groups, according to the UN.
We lost so many people, family members, loved ones, friends, neighbors.
State services have collapsed, and there is still fear amid widespread reports that the army and allied forces have been killing people suspected of being linked to the RSF. But despite all of this, people remain determined to rebuild their lives and to live with dignity.
It's completely destroyed, but the people are festive. There's a lot of people in the streets now. The city smells like we're smelling perfumes. People are wearing perfumes now, wearing very nice clothes, and the music is coming from everywhere, the chants, the celebrations. And don't forget, even when it gets dark and ugly, we're here around you, holding you down.
Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. As the Trump administration ramps up immigration enforcement efforts, advocates and attorneys say they are seeing higher levels of overcrowding at detention centers. And as WYPR's Emily Hofstetter reports from Baltimore, that overcrowding is often leading to inhumane conditions.
April Amaya Luis has been living in Maryland since crossing the southern border illegally 2 decades ago. On February 4th, she went for her routine check-in with her probation officer for a January misdemeanor assault.
When I left the appointment, I didn't imagine immigration officers would be waiting for me on my way out.
They handcuffed her, and by late that evening, she was transported to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Field Office in Baltimore, in a downtown federal office building. She says her room had no window. She was never taken outside for fresh air or recreation. She was held alone. Her attorneys say that could be because she's transgender.
Yo dormía en el suelo y en una...
I would sleep on the floor. There was a concrete structure that looked kind of like a stage. I would sleep there.
At first, she said she was given peanut butter and jelly sandwiches daily. But when she asked for something else, she said the guards stopped feeding her completely. She thinks she went between 4 and 5 days without food. Amaya Luis spent a total of 7 nights in a holding room that, per ICE policy, is only designed for a 12-hour stay. WYPR spoke with multiple lawyers who said their clients in other cities faced similar treatment. Attorney Rachel Gerard represents Amaya Luis and several others who have gone through the Baltimore holding rooms.
I was told yesterday by the person I consulted with that his family member was being held in a room where everybody had to sleep on the floor and it was 15 or 20 people in one room.
ICE didn't respond to multiple requests for an interview, but instead sent a statement saying they are committed to enforcing immigration laws fairly, safely, and humanely. The problem isn't isolated to Baltimore, and overcrowding has long been an issue at many ICE detention facilities. But it's gotten worse this year. ICE's existing detention facilities are at full capacity. The number of detainees has steadily increased since late January, when the Trump administration started reporting new data. At the Chrome Detention Center in Miami, litigation director Paul Chavez with Americans for Immigrant Justice says in March, they began to hear reports of people being kept on buses, in one case for as long as 3 days, until ICE could find additional space.
And one of the stories, they said that the bathroom on the bus overflowed and just, of course, was just awful. So basically stinking everybody out, people trying to get out of the bus or being forced to sleep back in it on the bus seats.
Chavez says clients have reported being in rooms where multiple people are sleeping on the floor. Many immigration advocates say this overflow is due to ICE's sweeping immigration crackdowns. Chavez and others say even a few months ago, ICE field officers would typically set most people up with an ankle monitor and a plan to check in with immigration courts.
So we're just seeing more and more people held, fewer and fewer people getting bond, much less prosecutorial discretion.
Immigration advocates say ICE could ease the problem by being more selective in who it detains. For NPR News, I'm Emily Hofstetter.
This is NPR News.
How free is America's free speech? We're asking Americans across the country about a constitutional guarantee. Many wanted us to obscure their names.
I'm definitely worried about getting reported.
Others are louder and bolder than ever. We begin a week-long series on the state of the First Amendment in the United States on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. In France, supporters of far-right leader Marine Le Pen are gathering in Paris today to protest the 5-year ban on her running for office. She had been convicted of embezzlement. Germany today marked the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the Buchenwald concentration camp. U.S. soldiers liberated the Nazi camp on April 11th of 1945. Holocaust survivors from across Europe attended today's memorial. And in women's college basketball, the title game will be this afternoon in Tampa, Florida. South Carolina plays the University of Connecticut. South Carolina is looking for its third national championship in 4 seasons. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. 17-year-old Diego Miguel Benavidez, or Benny, is studying hard and working a low-paying job as a busboy. He's trying to graduate high school, go to college, and make his mother proud. He's also got a childhood friend named Lawson, who's taking a different path.
Lawson says, "I need a ride." He always needs a ride. I don't mind, because I've never had a brother. But if I did, I'd want him to be just like Lawson. He's my ride or die, though preferably without the dying. Plus, Lawson always pays for gas. He pays with 2 crisp $10 bills, or 4 worn, tired fives, or 20 faded and wrinkled ones found in his pocket. The same tens and fives and ones he earns selling weed. I try not to mind. It's just weed, right?
That's Rex Ogle reading from his new novel in verse, When We Ride. And he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with Benny's ride. It's on the cover. Tell us about this car and what it meant to him.
Everyone has their first car, and it's such a memory. You can smell it, you can feel it, especially if it's an old, beat-up Cadillac. My best friend, she had this giant 1967 Cadillac, and we called it Big Bertha. And when she drove it, she had to turn that wheel around and around and around and around. And I mean, it was like sailing a massive boat. But it's, you know, Benny's first ride. It's big. He gets it from his mom. She's like, "You need this car more than I do. I could take the bus to work." And for him, it's a source of pride, but it's also something that enables him. It gives him power, especially in a world where he doesn't have much.
This novel takes place during Benny's senior year, and it's month by month. He's really focused on his future, and his goals are so different from Lawson's. Why are they such close friends? What draws them to each other?
You know, it's one of those friendships where you meet when you're a kid, you survive an event together, something small. In this case, it was bullying. Lawson stood up for him, and in that way, Benny was like, "Wow, this guy's taking care of me when I didn't have a father take care of me." And of course, Lawson doesn't have a father either. It doesn't take a lot, but when you're there for each other, especially when you don't have a male role model in your life, okay, we have to look out for each other.
But those differences, it's one thing when you're both 10 and you're playing Mario Kart, but by the time you get to their age, which is like 17, they're seniors, that's when those differences can really start to come into focus. Do you mind reading another poem from the book that gets at this?
Yeah, no problem. "When I step out, I'm wearing dirty shoes, holes in them. Jeans baggy, holes in them. U shirt from Goodwill. Backpack that I've had since middle school with stains on it. When Lawson steps out, he's wearing new shoes, bright white. Jeans baggy, brand new. New shirts, new polos, new jacket, gold chains around his neck, matching gold earrings with tiny diamonds in them. He looks pimp, OG. And I look broke, which I am. Am I jealous? I'd be lying if I said no.
Things are going to get bad between Benny and Lawson, and they kind of have these friendship breakups several times during the school year, but it just seems like Benny and Lawson, like, they can't quit the friendship. Why can't Benny leave Lawson alone, you think?
At least for me, you know, my best friend was dealing drugs. This was a reality. But the thing was he was a good kid doing bad things for good reasons. He was supporting his mom, who had a drug addiction. He was taking care of his third grade brother. He didn't want to be selling drugs, but, you know, I was working at Crystal's Pizza and Spaghetti Warehouse, cleaning tables, being a busboy, going back in the dishwasher and getting paid $3.85 an hour. And he's like, dude, he's like, you can make so much more dealing drugs. I just, that's a line I won't cross. So for me, Marshall, like, I loved him. He was my best bud, but I was trying not to judge him, but I was judging him. I think now as an adult, I have a different perspective.
What do you think we owe our friends in situations like that? What is the thing that we owe to our friends who've been there with us for years and since we were young and have supported us?
That's such a hard question because, I mean, as an adult, I come from a place of privilege and wisdom that I know things now that I wish I'd known when I was 15. I've been homeless. I've been super poor. I've dealt with domestic violence, the death of a sibling. Like, I have lived through a lot. I am the smartest 15-year-old around. But then my best friend, you know, I'm trying to go to school, and he's like, just take me to this one drug deal. In my head, I'm like, I'm risking everything. Like, sorry, that's a good question. Like, what do I owe him? And to me, I need to decide where the line for me stops. And that's a really hard line to draw in the sand, especially when you love someone.
I mean, this is a story, and obviously there are these tough circumstances. But because this is for young readers, did you feel any pressure to pull your punches or to soften the story?
I've been writing kids' books for a while, and there are publishers and editors who are like, no, you can't say that. You have to pull it back. But I feel like these stories are so important because this is reality. This is the truth of what kids are living through today. And I feel very privileged because I had an abuela who pushed me every day, every step of the way, get an education, work hard. I think a lot of people who come from where I do don't, or they get stuck. I'm really grateful to be able to tell a story that is feels honest and true and lived in.
What happened to Marshall? What happened to your best friend?
So it's a very different ending than the book. I introduced him to my other best friend. I had two best friends my senior in high school. Marshall was a drug dealer. Casey was class president. She was a straight-A student, blonde hair, blue eyes, beautiful, went to church. I introduced them. I hated it. I was so mad. I was so jealous because they fell in love. She got pregnant pretty soon after. His leukemia came back from when he was a kid. He passed, but their daughter is my goddaughter. It just makes me so happy that I have her.
Really, so much of Benny and Lawson's identities are part of the stories that they tell themselves about who they are, about what they could become. And it made me think about, like, how much of our destinies are determined by our circumstances and how much of it is determined by the kinds of decisions we make. What do you think of that?
I mean, I remember when I was in my 20s, like, I'd survived a lot and I was embarrassed and I was ashamed of where I came from. And it was infuriating because, you know, now I look back and I'm like, why were you ashamed? You didn't fail yourself. Society failed you. It wasn't your fault that you did what you did to survive. It wasn't Marshall's fault that he did what he did to survive. We didn't choose those situations. We were born into it and society perpetuated it. And man, it just drives me nuts because it's so easy for people to look at kids who are dealing drugs and be like, you're a bad person. You don't know anything about them. You know one thing. Talk to them and you'll find out why.
That's Rex Ogle. His new book is called When We Ride. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Jane Alexander has seen a lot over the 7 decades of her career. The Emmy and Tony Award-winning actor chaired the National Endowment for the Arts in the 90s when it was threatened by congressional lawmakers hostile to the NEA. How does that experience compare to current efforts to reshape the arts? Find out later today on All Things Considered on your phone, your smart speaker, or your radio. A sleepaway camp deep in the woods. Frisky young counselors letting loose by the pond. Eerie music. A mysterious killer, even someone named Jason. Hell of a Summer has all of the stuff for a good slasher film. But in this movie, Jason is a soft-spoken nice guy. And with every nod to a classic of the genre, there's also a subversive wink.
Hey, this is Finn Wolfhard.
Hi, this is Billy Brick.
Finn Wolfhard and Billy Brick wrote and directed Hell of a Summer, and they are stars in it as well. And they do a hell of a job.
Thank you so much.
How would you classify this movie? Is it a horror comedy or is it more of a comedy with a horror spin?
I think it can be both. I mean, I think we wanted to make a horror comedy that really treated its characters with care and respected its characters and cared about their dynamics as much as it cared about the kills. So at first we had sort of set out to make a coming-of-age teen comedy that gets interrupted by a slasher film. And that was kind of our like initial idea. It leads with comedy, but not in a way that feels like parody or feels like too satirical or too silly.
One thing that I did love about this movie, these characters do feel very real, and it's kind of like a Gen Z update to this. The way that they react when dead bodies start showing up is very how I felt like real teens would act.
One of the big reasons why we wrote the film was because we were kind of sick of seeing movies when characters are put into dangerous situations. They kind of just become heroes randomly, and it doesn't really feel like a part of their character. And so the idea behind these characters is just, what would you do in this situation? And would your insecurities and, you know, your sort of quirks go away? And the answer is no. They would actually probably be amplified in these moments of kind of stress or danger. And that's where a lot of the comedy also comes from.
Claire, stay back. He's the killer.
I'm not.
R2!
Get off of him!
You're the one who took our phones.
Yeah.
It's camp policy.
And you're the one that found Debbie's body.
Yeah.
That was a coincidence.
And you're like 45 and you still go to summer camp.
Yeah.
I'm only 24.
Say it for the jury.
Get off of him!
Claire, enough. He clearly hates himself, so he snapped and started killing off the hottest counselors.
Wait, what? Time out. We don't know that. That's subjective.
No, we do. It's obvious.
Billy, can you talk to me about some of the kind of archetypes that are in there? The jock, the popular girl, the theater kid, who's quite funny, the usual kind of high school stereotypes, but it done in a really interesting way.
I think part of the reason that the characters feel contemporary and updated is just because Finn and I are young, and we wrote this movie as teenagers. We were just trying to write characters that sort of felt like versions of people we knew. There was an authenticity sort of baked into our perspective. And we also knew the kind of characters we didn't want to write. I think there's a lot of very thin characters in slasher films from other eras because those were just the type of characters of that time. I think it just allowed us to write these characters that felt new and maybe fresh and like something we haven't seen in a slasher before.
Are y'all best friends in real life?
IRL?
Nope. Nope.
Well, no, we definitely are. We've been through so much together as friends. I'm 22 now. Billy's 25. I've known him since I was 16. He was 19. This is a movie that I think perfectly encapsulates our relationship at that time. It weirdly sort of mirrors the journey of our main character, Jason, and it is, at the end of the day, it's a movie about stepping out of your childhood and into adulthood and leaving certain things behind that meant a lot for you.
Well, that's the thing. So the lead character, he's the lead counselor, Jason. He's has this innocence, and he's holding on to summer camp. He's older. He's 24. In this movie, that's older.
Yeah, right. Compared to the 16-year-old, 17-year-old counselors.
Yeah. I guess, what do you think was the driving force for Jason?
Jason is someone that is at an age where life starts to get scary, I think, for the first time, and like you really have to start fending for yourself. And I think he's someone that cares so genuinely deeply about being a counselor at Camp Pine Way, and that it's been his safe and happy place. It's hard for him to let go.
Wait, why'd you come back?
Well, John and Kathy needed extra help, so yeah, I don't really see why it's such a big deal.
It's not a big deal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm just surprised because last year you said you weren't coming back.
Right, but
you were like crying.
I don't think I was crying.
You were definitely crying. You were like sobbing. You gave that end of an era speech.
For me, at least, when we started writing the script, I had just dropped out of college, and there was that feeling of a structure to being in school all the time that you know for basically your entire childhood, really. Now I had to go figure out how to find structure in my own life, and like as an actor and as a writer, as a director, it's not the most structured lifestyle at all. There's something that was really exciting about making a movie about that period of time, and we talked a lot about movies like The Graduate. That's really a movie that has sort of similar themes about somebody who is now not sure what to do with the rest of their life. For Jason, you know, it's a terrible thing that happens when all these characters start getting killed off in increasingly gruesome ways, but at the same time, it's kind of the thing that he needs to kickstart
the next chapter of his
life. So it's the only thing that would shake this guy away from this summer camp is if a bunch of people started getting killed there. And that's exactly what we did to him.
That's what you did. I gotta ask you, though, like, when you think of these sorts of stories, why do you think we keep coming back to summer camp to tell these sorts of stories?
It's a universal social setting, and it, I think, gives a great opportunity to have these characters interact with each other because they're all going through sort of similar things at the same time.
The other thing that's so interesting about summer camp is it's an opportunity for young people to sort of reinvent themselves. It can be a very formative experience for a lot of people. Finn and I didn't really go to sleepaway camp. Well, I did for 1 week. I went to basketball camp. It's a story for another day. But part of the reason we wanted to make a summer camp movie is because we wanted to go to summer camp. And it was some of the most fun we've ever had.
That's Billy Brick and Finn Wolfhard, who directed and starred in the movie Hell of a Summer, out now. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
Too darn hot. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. But I ain't up to my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to cool with my baby tonight and
pitch the woo with my baby tonight. I'd like to coo with my baby tonight and pitch the woo with my baby tonight. But brother, you fight.